Hello and welcome to addclasses.com. My name is Tara McGillicuddy and I am the founder and director of addclasses.com. And tonight we have the second part of our webinar event, Understanding and Applying the Science of Time Management, with Dr. Tuckman. And we're going to begin in just a moment. Dr. Tuckman will be answering questions at the end of the hour. But he will be answering a lot of the questions throughout the hour during the presentation. So what I suggest is to listen for a good 40 minutes, you know, come up with any questions during it, maybe jot it down on a piece of paper. And then if your question has not been answered, to submit it, you know, later on, like towards the last 45 minutes of the presentation. So with that, I'm going to welcome Dr. Ari Tuckman back to ADD Classes for the second part of our presentation. Welcome back.
All right. Thanks. It's good to be here. So I'm glad that we could do this kind of back-to-back here. So we could do yesterday on understanding the science of time management, and then today is really more about applying the science of time management. So hopefully you've had a chance to listen to the first session before you listen to this second one, because I think you'll get more out of this session if you've listened to the first one first. But just to kind of go back a little bit, to summarize, there were two big concepts that came out of yesterday, and that kind of sets the stage for the what do we do about it stuff today. So the first big concept was that of time horizon, which basically the idea is, how close in time does something need to be in order for somebody to feel it and to see it and then feel activated to do something about it? So folks with ADHD, their time horizon tends to be shorter. So things have to come closer in time before they see that and then they get going and do something about it. The second concept is what's called temporal discounting. And that is the basic idea of that is that things happening in the present, we feel them more than we would feel something happening in the future. So thinking about staying up late tonight, boy, that sure is fun. I'm having fun right now. But then to think about what do I need to do tomorrow? How will I feel tomorrow if I get to bed late and I don't get enough sleep? We discount that pain. We don't feel that pain as much in this moment until we then feel it in a later moment. So time horizon and temporal discounting kind of set the stage for what we're talking about today. So basically we're talking about two different ideas. One is the idea of see time by externalizing it. And the second concept we're talking about, which we'll get to kind of in the second half here, is to feel time by maximizing motivation. So it's about seeing time, but also feeling time, and thereby being motivated to do something about it. So so just to begin then, like we talked about last time, time management is really pretty multifaceted, that there's a lot of different parts involved in time management. So some people could have a harder time with some aspects of it than they do with other aspects of it. So you might be stronger in some facets and weaker in some others, as we are all stronger in some things and weaker in others. So it can help then if you're working on your time management or your child's or your partner's or whatever, to look for examples in your life to help you identify really what are the weakest links, like where are the specific situations, either in general, you know, this is always kind of a struggle, or the specific situations like at work or at home or getting ready to leave for a meeting or whatever, like what are the specific situations that tend to be more of a struggle than others? And if you kind of compare and contrast the situations that are more of a struggle in the situations that are less of a struggle and go pretty well, you may be able to figure out, what are your weak links. Now, in order to manage time well, often we need to manage attention well first. So one of the ways of helping you manage time more effectively is to create a good work environment. So whatever it is that means to you, but creating a situation that has fewer distractions, that all that stuff that takes you off track and that kind of messes up your timing and messes up your schedule, take those things away as much as you can, so that you're able to focus on just the things that you need to get done, especially the stuff that's really fun and really interesting. You definitely want to take that stuff away. Or as I sometimes say, it's easier to not be tempted when there are fewer temptations. So as much as you can, and sometimes we can't, but as much as you can, eliminate those distractions, because getting sidetracked onto other things is going to mess up your time management. It's going to add time to the things that you need to do. Another kind of basic idea here is to add as many clocks as possible to your life, or at least in those situations where there isn't a clock and you find yourself then losing track of time, add in a clock there. Or add in alarms and reminders of various kinds, other sorts of things. So kind of externalize it. So if your internal clock doesn't tick loudly enough for you to hear it and to know what to do, you know, from one moment to the next, external reminders will then help you kind of keep it in mind and stay on track. Then, of course, you need to actually get into the habit of looking at the clocks, and then once you look at the clock and see what time it is, you need to actually then act on that time. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the second half when we talk about feeling time. So right now we're just talking about kind of being aware of time, but then we'll talk about being motivated to do something in relation to time. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about just some kind of basic concepts about kind of managing time more effectively. So in my workbook, I talked about these kind of key concepts, as I call them. I've presented on them, you know, in executive function presentations and other places. So I'm going to repeat it a little bit here, but then there's a bunch of new stuff that kind of follows. But I think the basic ideas are still good ones. So the idea of these, what I call key concepts, is that there's all sorts of strategies out there in the world of ADHD on managing time more effectively in terms of reminders and schedule systems and all sorts of great stuff. And there's lots of presenters who do a really good job of kind of presenting all sorts of good ideas about it. But when I was looking at all those different strategies and systems and techniques and whatnot, I was thinking about it, and this is just kind of the way my mind works, is that I realized that, you know, when you boil it all down, really all those 101 time management techniques or whatever, they really boil down to these three basic concepts. In that if you can remember the basic concepts, it's much easier then to figure out what to do in any one specific situation. So if you know the general, you can kind of figure out the specific a little bit more easily. So the first key concept then is supplement your internal sense of time with plenty of clocks and external reminders. Now that certainly makes sense, and we've been talking about that before. The second key concept is use alarms and other limits to notify you that a specific time has arrived. So this is a little bit of a more specific idea. So it's not just being aware of time in general, but it's being aware of a specific time, as in, uh-oh, it's 3 o'clock. I really better wrap up and get out of here because I need to get to that meeting. And then finally, the third key concept is use a schedule to plan out your time. So we're going to talk about schedules a bunch more, but let's kind of go through some more specific examples of each of these key concepts. So the first key concept is supplement your internal sense of time with plenty of clocks and external reminders. So there's lots and lots of ways to do this, but I'll rattle off kind of a few sort of representative examples so that you can kind of get the gist of what I'm talking about, but really so that you can take it and apply it into your own life. But if you know the general concepts, that's kind of easier to do. So obviously, then one of the solutions that falls under here is to just put up a bunch of clocks so that you're aware of the time. But a little twist on that is that analog clocks, meaning like the old-fashioned kind that has two hands that move across, you know, the clock, around clock face, analog clocks actually can work better or more effective than digital clocks. And the reason is analog clocks are tangible. You see that hand moving. You see that hand coming from one part of the clock face moving towards a number on the other side of the clock face. So you can see the time more directly, as opposed to looking at numbers on a digital clock. It's just a bunch of lines that kind of change position, but you have to abstract it. So when you look at the clock and it says 9:10, what does that mean? Like, you know, you need to kind of think about it, what that means, and how close is 9:10 to 9:50. Again, you need to think about it, whereas if you have an analog clock, you can see how far 9:10 is from 9:50, and as you're getting close to that 9:50 time. Another idea that falls under this idea of, you know, supplementing your internal sense of time is wearing a watch that beeps regularly. So if it beeps every 15 minutes and maybe has a different chime for 15, for 30, for 45, and then bam, for the hour, just so that you become, it's just a little bit of a time marker as the day goes on. Another idea, making a habit of checking the time regularly. Again, having the clocks is nice, but if you're not actually looking at them and pausing for a moment to think about them, it doesn't sort of sink in and register. And then finally, related to time, is when you look at the clock, that you then ask yourself, you try to get into the habit of saying, so what should I be doing now? That's the time, but what should I be doing now? Because if you remember, time management is tasks in relation to time. So it's about the task, what am I doing, but it's also about what time is it, and am I doing the right task at the right time? The next set of key concepts has to do, or the next examples of key concepts has to do with the idea of using alarms and other limits to notify you that a specific time has arrived. Now, if at all possible, you want a reminder to be at what's called the point of performance, or in other words, the time and place that you can actually do something about it. So leaving a note on the door going out of the house that says, remember to take an umbrella. Or better yet, leaving the umbrella in front of the door in such a way that you can't open the door without knocking over the umbrella, as opposed to leaving a note in the kitchen that you then need to remember as you're going out the door. And any time we set a delay there, we're all more likely to forget. Or sending yourself an email to your work email from home so that when you get to work, you see it there and you can then do that thing. Or leaving a voicemail, or using kind of all, there's these new kind of high-tech things like, you know, location-based alarms. So you set it that, you know, when I get home, then the alert pops up that says, remember to take the frozen chicken out of the freezer. So you don't get an alarm at a specific time, because if you get stuck in traffic, that doesn't help, but it actually is at the right place. So there's all sorts of interesting things you can do. another set of examples here has to do with putting your lights or the TV or the computer or your browser or whatever on a shut-off timer. I know someone who gets stuck kind of tinkering on the computer. He programs his computer to shut itself down at a specific time. Bam, that's the end of the messing around on the computer. If you're going to set an alarm, it's often helpful to, before you set the alarm, or perhaps after, but to avoid activities that are really engrossing, that you tend to get stuck hyper-focusing on, because it's just too slippery. It's too easy to stay stuck there and not move on to the next thing. Another example here is to peg your schedule to somebody else's. So, for example, get into bed when somebody else is getting into bed. You know, so you don't say, well, I'll get into bed when I get into bed, but you get in when your partner gets into bed, because they tend to get into bed at about the right time, and it just, there's more of a consistency there. You're more likely to kind of hit the bullseye more days out of the week. And then finally, the third and final key concept here is the idea of using a schedule. And we're going to talk, you know, a little bit more at length about using a schedule. So I think it's important to have a schedule for most people, maybe not everybody, but for most people. So, and not just an overall schedule, but also to have like a daily schedule. So what am I doing today? If you need to, pad your estimates, add some extra time, especially if you know that you tend to underestimate. And many people do tend to underestimate, and folks with ADHD also tend to underestimate. So just add in some extra time just in case. In your schedule book, I think it's also, or your schedule software, whatever, you need to schedule in time, or you're probably better off scheduling in time to get ready, to transition from one thing to the next, to clean up, or to travel to and to travel back. And that needs to be in the schedule and blocked out. So the 2 o'clock appointment doesn't just get written at 2 o'clock, but maybe at 1:30 it says travel, and at 1:15 it says get ready. And then, of course, you do the same thing on the back end of that 2 o'clock appointment. Then when you have the schedule, to then consult it, actually take a look at it anytime circumstances change, and actively move things around within your schedule rather than just kind of keeping it up in our head, which is tempting because we all like the idea of keeping it up in our heads, but it tends not to work as well. I think it's helpful also to break up large chunks of time. So, you know, the example here I always use is the morning routine, that if you've got an hour or something between waking up and getting out the door, that's a lot of time to keep in mind and to sort of mentally track, as opposed to if you can put a post-it notes for the different at the different places for the different times that you should be there. So, for example, you know, out of bed and into the bathroom at 7:30, down to the kitchen by, you know, 7:50, preparing lunch by, you know, 8:10 or whatever. So you kind of put these post-it notes. You're only tracking smaller pieces of time. So you're only tracking 20 minutes in the bathroom. Am I ahead or am I behind? What time is it? I got to be out of here at what time? 7:50? Okay. Is it before 7:50 or is it after 7:50? And that way, if you are running a little bit behind, you can potentially make that up on the next one. Whereas if you don't realize until the very end that you're running behind, then that's harder to make up. So when it comes to then doing the right things at the right times, the first thing that needs to happen is you need to know what your target is. The second thing is you need to track your target. But on the first one of knowing your target, you know, like I said, it's hard to do the right thing at the right time if you don't know, first of all, what time is it now? And second of all, what am I supposed to be doing now? So given that, in order to have a life that's not too kind of all over the place and not just kind of reactive to whatever's happening in the moment, we all need some sort of a schedule system. And that the goal of the schedule system is about achieving the goals that are important to you. It's not about having a schedule system because that's kind of morally the thing that adults do or whatever nonsense, but it's just about this is something that's going to be helpful. So if it will be helpful to you based on your own assessment and your own decision, then do it. It doesn't need to be super complicated. It doesn't need to be super high tech even, but some sort of a system is usually helpful for most people. But what's hard is that for a lot of folks who've had kind of chronic struggles with time management, they often kind of resist committing to a schedule system. And there's a couple possible reasons. On the one hand, it could just be sort of pessimism in the sense of like, you know what, I've had lots of schedules. It never worked out. Eventually I just lose it or I stop writing in it. Why should I get another one? And, you know, given the track record, I understand the pessimism. At the same time, of course, as a psychologist who kind of works with people to make positive changes in their life, I would also like to think that, well, maybe if we can find you a better schedule system, it'll work a little bit better. Maybe if we can find new ways to use your schedule system, possibly taking this ADHD thing into account, and maybe, I don't know, you're taking some medication for ADHD now that you weren't before, or it's optimized in a more effective way. So maybe there's actually some reason for optimism here. Some other folks are hesitant to use to commit to a time management system because they don't want to be kind of held to it in the sense of like, ugh, if I put this down that, you know, next Tuesday at 4 I need to do this meeting, what if I don't want to do the meeting Tuesday at 4? But now I'm sort of stuck with it. And I get that you may not be in the mood Tuesday at 4 to do that thing. But unfortunately, I don't know, I guess that's not really a schedule problem. That's more of a kind of mindset thing that sometimes we just got to do what we don't want to do. Or it doesn't mean you have to do it Tuesday at 4, but at least if you know that that's when it is, then you can make a decision at that point about whether to do it or not. If you forget that you need to do it Tuesday at 4, then it's, you know, there's no choice to be made. The choice has been made for you by the forgetting. But at the end of the day, whatever schedule system you use, the more you use it, the better it works. The more that you integrate it into your life, the more often you're putting stuff in, the more reminders you get about what's already in there. So if you can start it and commit to it, it hopefully begins to get a bit of momentum behind it. Let's talk then kind of real quick here about kind of the difference between schedules and to-do lists. So these are both great tools, but they're different tools for different jobs. In that sometimes when people sort of struggle with getting things done, it's not just that they don't necessarily have one good system, but they're kind of blurring these two systems. So the job of a schedule system, again, whether it's paper or electronic or whatever, is schedules are used to track time-specific tasks. In other words, tasks that are supposed to happen at a specific time, so like an appointment or a meeting or a phone call at a specific time or whatever. Whereas to-do lists are really more for kind of like time non-specific tasks. So this thing might have a deadline, as in like this has to be done by, you know, the end of Friday, let's say, but it doesn't need to be done at a specific time. So it's due by the end of work on Friday, but I could do it on Friday, I could do it on Tuesday, I could do it on Thursday. It doesn't matter when. It just has to get done at some point. That's really more of a to-do list kind of a thing, in if we're really being kind of like narrow about it. But having said that, there's a bit of flexibility in there. And at the end of the day, people who are successful and generally kind of getting things done, they really kind of have both. Like I said, they're different tools for different jobs. And the people who say, well, I can just remember everything, usually it's not a sign of someone with an awesome memory who really actually is able to remember everything. But if anything, it's either a sign that they don't realize kind of how bad their memory is, or it's a sign that they just don't want to commit to this whole schedule thing. Or at best, saying, I can just remember it all, is really just kind of, it's the sign that your life is way too simple. That, you know, as I say, if you can remember everything that you have going on, then you don't have enough going on. In other words, your life should be bigger than your brain's ability to remember all those moving pieces. You want to have a big, interesting life with lots of stuff going on. So in terms of schedules then, obviously there are paper schedule systems, and then there are electronic schedule systems, and there's all sorts of different permutations and variations. Really, at the end of the day, you just want to find what works best for you. Folks who don't have a lot of things going on, who have fewer scheduled items, probably do better with an electronic system that has alarms that pop up. Because if you keep looking in your paper schedule book and there's nothing in there, eventually you just stop looking. Whereas if you set a reminder in your phone, let's say, it'll remind you at the right time and place. Sometimes, though, as much as I sort of talked about schedules and to-do lists being different tools for different jobs, you know, sometimes I recommend, often maybe I recommend, that people take to-do list items, these like non-specific items, and they put them into specific times in their schedule. And the reason is that stuff that sits on a to-do list can just sort of like sit there forever, because it becomes this thing of like, well, is now the time to work on that? I don't know. How about now? Well, what about now? Is now the time to work on that? Or do I do these other things instead? And it creates a situation where it just never gets done. So by taking stuff off of the to-do list and putting it into the schedule, I'm going to do this Wednesday at 10, it just makes it more likely to happen. And this is especially helpful for things that maybe have certain time constraints. So like you have to call somebody, but they're only open during business hours. So maybe you put that into your schedule during like the earlier part of the business hours. It also has the added benefit that as you begin to put stuff into your schedule, as you begin to put these tasks into your schedule, what you begin to see is how your schedule is filling up. So that thing of like, I don't know what happened, but somehow the whole day was gone and I, you know, still had all these other things I had to do. It makes that less likely to happen because you can see like, man, this day is really filling up already. I got to either take some stuff out or move it around, or I just need to not take anything new on. But again, it becomes like that analog clock. It's more tangible. It's more visible. You can see it a little bit more clearly that way. This brings up the question, and I was talking to my wife about this morning or last night or something. There's a question of how long does something actually take? And when somebody asks the question, well, how long does it take you to do that, there's really a number of different answers to that. And this is, of course, where it gets a little bit complicated in terms of planning purposes. So how long a task takes, on the one hand, there's the smallest number, which is the time actually spent working. So if we had a stopwatch and we started it when you were working, we stopped it when you did something else, and we started it again as soon as you went back to working on it, that's like the shortest possible amount of time. But potentially there's a couple other add-on times that we need to factor in. So one of them is the time needed to find all the necessary items or all the information, like who am I supposed to call? What was that phone number again? Or, you know, God, where the hell is my hammer? I knew it's around here somewhere. The more disorganized you are, it adds more time to that before you get started part of how long a task takes. But we also then need to add in the additional time that's spent on other stuff, so taking breaks, getting distracted, dealing with interruptions that come up, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, the longer a task takes, the more that's involved with it, the more likely that additional time needs to be factored in. So the more complicated your task is, probably the more you want to pad your estimate and add a little bit more to it. So that's the strategies, that's kind of like the first half. We're about seeing time more effectively by externalizing it. Now, let's shift gears a little bit now, and let's talk about feeling time. So it's not just seeing it, but it's feeling it and thereby being kind of spurred to action by maximizing motivation. So most things in life, you know, most moments in life involve this constantly shifting balance between all the different competing goals and the competing tasks and the competing interests that we have, which can make it hard to decide what to do in any one specific moment. Should I do this or should I do that or that or that or that or that? And of course, some tasks in front of us, some options are a whole lot more interesting and appealing than others. So that kind of tilts the balance a little bit in terms of what we do, especially, you know, with that temporal discounting, that phenomenon that we feel the present pleasure or pain more than we feel future pleasure or pain. Now, the problem with life then is that most tasks tend to involve long delays before natural consequences kick in. So things like if you file your tax return late, it could be a long time before you actually pay any kind of price for it, either literally paying an extra fee because it was late, or you pay a price in the sense that, like, you know, your cell phone plan has expired and you need to, like, go for a new one, but, or maybe that's a bad example, but, you know, your car explodes and you need to go get a new car. They want to see your tax returns and your income and whatever, and you don't have a current tax return. So that could be months or maybe years later that you pay that price. Unhealthy eating also, again, that price gets paid down the road. Not doing daily homework, probably you don't pay a big price the next day, but you pay a price down the road at the end of the quarter or the semester or whatever. So if we are only affected by the natural consequences, it's easy to not do a lot of things. So it's this temporal discounting that, and, you know, maybe one way of putting it is that temporal discounting kills natural consequences, that the further out something is, the less we feel it, which can create a situation for a lot of folks with ADHD that by the time they feel it, it's too late. And this could almost be like the unofficial slogan of ADHD time management. By the time I feel it, it's too late. You know, when those natural consequences are kicking in, it's too late to change it. You know, that ship has already sailed at that point. So in order to feel natural consequences, those kind of distant natural consequences, we need to basically take our past experiences. You know, what was some similar experience I'd been in that worked out well or that worked out not well? And how do I take that, those past experiences, and sort of recreate the feeling from the past experience in the present moment so that I can then activate and work towards a future goal, something I want to happen or something I want to prevent from happening? It's harder for folks to do that, to pause and to take those past experiences and really feel them in the moment so they can activate for the future. Now, it doesn't mean that folks with ADHD never can do this, because certainly lots of times they can, but just compared to folks without ADHD, folks with ADHD less often are able to bring those past experiences into the present and use them in the service of pursuing future goals. So there's a bunch of ways then that you can bring the future more into the present. So I'm going to run through these and then I'll give some examples. But the more ways, so to speak, the more of these five different ways that you can bring into a situation, probably the more you're going to feel that time and feel motivated to do something about it. So we can bring the future more into the present by making consequences more immediate, more frequent, more external, more salient, and more consistent. So let me give some examples and then I'll run through the list again. So making consequences more immediate. So for example, I have a colleague who has this billing program that does not allow her to bill a session until she has written a progress note for it, which I think is brilliant because, of course, billing the session is a thing that you want to be able to do, but it forces you to write that progress note. And for a lot of therapists or coaches or whatever, that forcing themselves to write the progress note is a real challenge because, you know, you're busy and you got other things to do, and it's like, I'll just do it later, but then you forget to do it later and you forget the details. And then a week later, the client shows up and you go back to read your progress note and you're like, oh, man, I didn't write it. What did we talk about? So that by the time you feel the pain a week from now, it's already too late. But if you have this particular billing program, that will never happen because you're forced to write the note before you're able to bill the session. Another facet here, we want to make consequences more frequent. So, for example, rather than having that one big meeting with your boss at the very end of a project, maybe have a number of more frequent check-ins. So let's check in at this point, at this point, at this point, which activates you earlier. You'll feel those consequences more quickly, sooner in time, if your boss says, you know, I was kind of hoping you'd be a little further along by this point. That's better to hear a week into a project than it is to hear a month into a project. We also want to make the consequences more external. So, for example, if you know that you tend to run late and you're having meeting a friend for dinner, you tell that friend, here's the deal, if I'm more than 10 minutes late, I got to buy your dinner. Now, there's nothing inherently connected about running late and buying dinner other than it's something of a social convention. But if you know, like, oh, man, I'm going to be on the hook for $25 here or whatever, perhaps you're more likely to do what you need to do earlier in the day to get yourself there on time. We also want to make our consequences more salient. In other words, more clear, we want to feel them more. So, for example, this is an idea, I'm taking this idea from Nancy Rady, who wrote this in her book, where she talked about to force herself to write pages for the book, she would take her laptop somewhere, she would leave the plug at home, and then just sit there and watch the battery slowly drain away until finally it came to a low enough point that she was like, oh my God, and she would then fly into this flurry of activity and write the 3 or 5 pages or whatever that she needed to for the day. So it really kind of puts the pressure on, that dying battery puts the pressure on in a way that sitting at the office with the thing plugged in possibly might not. Finally, we want to bring the future into the present by making consequences more consistent. So I think a great example of this is, you know, if you're trying to lose weight or eat healthier, a dieting app that gives you daily calorie totals and daily whatever totals, protein and fat and whatever. We're doing like regular weigh-ins at Weight Watchers. That clear consistency of the feedback from, you know, that you get quick and consistent feedback about your eating habits. It just makes it work out better as opposed to this kind of vague sense of like, I think I'm eating more healthy these days. So again, we want to bring the future into the present by making our consequences more immediate, more frequent, more external, more salient, and more consistent. So the more of those 5 that you can add into a particular situation, probably the better it's going to work out for you. Especially in situations where the natural consequences just don't come quickly enough. And in those cases, you want to impose some sort of artificial consequences in order to kind of feel more motivated to do it. So like we talked about with that kind of the response inhibition theory of ADHD, that folks with ADHD are more likely to get sort of to focus in on the present moment, and that focusing too much on the present moment interferes with thinking about and feeling the future because we're focused in feeling the present moment too much. So there's something to be said for kind of instilling a habit of really making a point of disengaging from whatever it is that you're doing in the moment. We're scheduling in like pauses through the day to think about like, okay, what am I doing? What's going on? Where are these current actions going to bring me into the future? Like, how is this going to work out? How am I going to feel about this at the end of the day? How am I going to feel about this tomorrow and next week and next year? And to really think about that future as vividly as possible. So really sort of put yourself into that future situation. Think about it. How is that going to look? How am I going to feel there? Or another way of putting it is, how is your future self going to feel about your present self? So is yourself from a week from now going to look back and say, man, my last week self, boy, did that guy screw me on this one. Man, if that guy had gotten more work done on Monday, I'd be a lot happier today on Friday or whatever. So whatever kind of mechanism works, but to really kind of think and to feel, to make a point of feeling that future consequence and not just sort of skipping along as is very easy to do in life these days. So I think, you know, mindfulness and that idea of being in the present moment really kind of fits in here. When you get right down to it, all this time management stuff, especially what we talked about yesterday, especially what we talked about in the first part of today, it's really kind of like a cold, so to speak, set of cognitive skills. So it's kind of cold meaning unemotional. It's a cognitive set of skills. It's about thinking. It's not so much about feeling. But ultimately, time management also involves the more hot emotions, the motivation to use those skills. So, for example, you might become aware, oh, I have this thing due tomorrow. You're totally aware of it. It's in your attention. You know about it. You understand the deal. But just decide not to do it. So that's not really a time management problem, at least if we narrowly define it, because you're aware of what needs to be done. You're aware of how long it's going to take, and you're aware of what time it is now. So sense of time, it creates an awareness maybe, but we then need to use our motivation to actually do something, to act on that information. And that's where the feeling the future comes in. The problem is that it's not just about like strict neurology. There's also all that psychology that gets worked in. So that if you're kind of ambivalent about a task, like kind of like, yeah, I guess I should do it, but I don't know, I'm not really that motivated, or worse than ambivalent, where you're just like, ugh, I really don't want to do that, where you're kind of resistant to the idea, then if that's the case, like we may not even put it into our schedule. Like, yeah, I know I need to do that, but I don't feel like writing it down. Well, we don't set an alarm in the first place. So we set ourselves up then to kind of like forget or to have it get squeezed out of our tasks because we're not really kind of making that commitment to getting it done, which can make it look like a time management problem, but it's not necessarily that simple. You know, it becomes a question of like, is this like motivated forgetfulness that we're kind of like motivated to not remember it? Or is it just sort of avoidance masquerading as procrastination? So we're just avoiding dealing with something, but it looks kind of like that sort of ADHD style of procrastination, that time horizon, that it's not close enough yet to activate the person into action, but really they just don't want to deal with it and they're kind of avoiding it. So if that's the case, my easy to say, hard to do advice is to just own up to it, in that it's, if you really don't want to do it, it may be better to just say that right up front. Don't delay, don't avoid, don't let it sort of fall off your to-do list. Just say it right up front and maybe, you know, have a different kind of conversation about it rather than a conversation where here we go again, you've disappointed me, blah, 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 and that whole kind of unproductive discussion. In addition, there's also the kind of the broader idea of mindset. So how well we manage time and how likely we are to complete something is also influenced by the mindset that we have about the task. So for example, how confident are you in being successful at it? If you feel it's unlikely to be successful, that's pretty easy not to be motivated to do it. I think it's important also, like, what's the specific discomfort involved with a task? Do you feel uncertain about it? Is it boring? Is it frustrating? Is it confusing? Do you need to ask someone and you feel kind of shy about asking them? Like, what's the specific discomfort that's involved in the task? And what's your willingness to tolerate that discomfort? So you don't enjoy it, obviously, it's a discomfort, but can you deal with it? Are you willing to deal with it? And, of course, some of that is influenced by your ability to see and then feel the future benefit of that sacrifice in the present. So it's not just suffering to suffer, but it's suffering for the purpose of something bigger and better. And, of course, there are many things in life that involve suffering in the moment in the pursuit of something better. The mindset that we have towards the task is also influenced by what are the social repercussions? Like, if I do this or don't do it, how is that going to play out in terms of other people? How are they going to feel? How are they going to act towards me? And then, of course, we have to consider how does this task compare to the other options, the other stuff competing for my attention and energy. The more interesting things, options you have to do instead, the harder it is to have a positive mindset about doing it. For some people who are really anxious or they're kind of perfectionistic or they have low self-esteem, in those situations, it may be that the priority is not necessarily to get this task done or that task done, but it's really more about managing discomfort. And it, in all of these things, anxiety, perfectionism, low self-esteem, can kind of create situations that look like time management problems, but they're really about these other things that get in the way of the person sort of doing what they need to do. So if you feel for yourself that one of these things is going on, that there's this other emotional piece getting in the way, if that's the case, then just setting more alarms or buying a new schedule program is not going to be the solution, because it's not about not knowing what needs to be done. It's about getting up and going on it. And if that's the case, you may need to address that anxiety or perfectionism or whatever in some other way before you can come back to these kind of like strategies and systems and whatnot. If you do choose to use a system, if to kind of either tweak the system you've got, the schedule and to-do list system, or to create a new one or adopt a new one, I was saying that competence breeds confidence. So having faith that, like, okay, I think this is going to work pretty good is motivating to use it, or at least it's more motivating to use than to feel like, ugh, I don't think this is going to work that good. And that, generally speaking, as in most things in life, good systems and strategies are created by persistently adding gradual refinements to what start out as kind of bad systems. So start with whatever you got and then make it a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better. And definitely don't go overboard. Don't go perfectionistic. Don't jump from one brand new system to another brand new system. Just use it for what it needs to be done. It's a tool to be used. That's it. Nothing more. It's just a tool to be used. And when you don't feel like using it, remind yourself as vividly as possible, like, what are the benefits? What am I getting out of this? Why do I want to keep doing this thing? And it doesn't need to be perfect, but even if this system only works half the time, that's still half better than you were doing before. So even partial improvement can sometimes feel meaningful and like it's worth doing. Final note here then, when we're talking about kind of feeling time and being motivated to do what needs to be done, involves the idea of learning to say no. That basically it kind of comes down to preserving motivation for the task at hand by declining other tasks that may take your time and attention and energy away. And it's, you know, again, easy to say, but it's hard to do, because overcommitting is really easy. Besides the social pressure component of it that anybody might feel, if you tend to underestimate how long things are going to take, it's easy to say, oh, yeah, sure, I can do that thing. Throw it on the pile. I'll get it done tomorrow. No problem. It's also easy to overcommit if you overestimate how much time you have available because you didn't check your schedule first. So you didn't look in the schedule and say, like, ooh, actually, I don't really have that much time. Or if you did check your schedule, if you haven't been pretty good about putting stuff into your schedule or onto your to-do list, you may assume that you have more time than, in fact, you actually do. So this trouble with saying no, it's not really actually a time management problem, but ironically, it can create a time management problem where you're not getting done either the new task or the existing tasks or all of the above. So let's now shift gears a little bit and let's take some questions. Hopefully kind of this whole process from the beginning of yesterday, talking about time horizon, talking about temporal discounting, and then how that sort of led into today, talking about, you know, time horizon kind of connected to seeing time more by externalizing it, and then temporal discounting leading into today with feeling time more, feeling the future more. Hopefully that those threads kind of make sense and that you can sort of take all of this into a bigger context and understand why the time management strategies that you use already, why they work, the ones that do work, why do they work, and possibly the ones that don't really work that well, maybe this gives some sense of like, oh, that's why those don't work that well. Of course, all with an eye towards coming up with good strategies and systems that really will work most effectively for you by understanding some of this, these kind of deeper concepts that underlie time management. But Tara, if you got any questions for us, let's do it.
Yeah, you answered a lot of them. And if you would like to ask a question, you do need to type it in, and we won't be taking them over the telephone. The first question is, how many clocks do you actually recommend someone having? When you talked about having a lot of clocks, all I could picture was, I think it was Back to the Future with Doc, whatever his name was, with like hundreds of clocks on the walls. What would you recommend, like, somebody start with when they go and get some clocks?
Yeah, well, so that's a good question. I think it depends. I think it's a question. It's not only how many, it's also what kind of clocks and how big should they be. So I think it really comes down to kind of like the proof is in the pudding, meaning if you find yourself drifting off of schedule because you don't know what time it is, because where you are you can't see what time it is, then that means you need one more clock. And if that does the trick, then we're done. And if you still find yourself too often not knowing what time it is, then I guess you need at least one more clock or a bigger clock, or it needs to be in a different place or something, so that you don't have to work that hard to find out what time it is. And despite the fact that most of us use our phones these days as our clocks, although now with these smart watches coming out, actually watches are kind of coming back. Phones are great for time, except putting your hand in your pocket, pulling it out, pressing the button, swiping across, putting in your key thing. Like, it's too many steps, and you're not going to check the time as often, as opposed to if you've got a bunch of clocks scattered around where you live and where you work or whatever. It's just going to work out better. Like, the easier something is, the more likely we are to do it.
In the phone, I mean, you can go to, or I'll use myself an example. I've taken out my phone to check what time it is. Like, 5 minutes later, I forgot what I was checking my phone for. So, and I'm sure other people on here can relate. So I think that's another reason to have a clock in addition to your phone or tablet or whatever else.
Yeah, I mean, it's like keeping the diet celery you're supposed to be eating in the cookie jar. You know, like, oh, I'm opening the cookie jar.
Yep.
Whoa, look at those. Yeah, I mean, the phone is the most distracting thing in the world, and to use that as your thing to mark time and then not get distracted by it takes a lot more willpower and a little bit more luck than probably, you know, most of us could muster.
I know you talked somewhat about this when you were talking about schedules and padding time. But what do you recommend for somebody who tries to use the planner or schedule and puts it in, but then keeps learning and finding out that things are taking a lot longer to do than they've actually scheduled time for?
Right. So I've got a couple thoughts on that. On the one hand, my first thought is, okay, why is it taking so much longer? You know, so to step back and to try to figure out, like, where is extra time going? Am I really just totally underestimating a reasonable amount of time that this should take? Like, is that the thing? Or is the problem that I'm getting interrupted too much? Is the problem that I'm interrupting myself too much? So, like, I'm going off on lots of side projects and getting distracted onto other things. Like, is that the problem? So, you know, the first thing you want to do is figure out where that extra time is going. And either you just need to pad your estimates even more, or you need to change something. So, like, if you keep getting interrupted, to do something to reduce some of those interruptions. If you keep getting distracted, to, if as much as you can, reduce the distractions in the first place. But my second thought is, just because you find that those initial estimates are way off, do not give up too soon. This is all part of the process, and this is really useful information. Like, you are learning this process of writing, of putting stuff in and realizing you're underestimating is helpful. This is important to know, and you just keep going at it where you're examining where that time is going, or you're adding in a little bit more, and let's see if that does the trick. Nope, okay, let's add in a little bit more, let's see if that does the trick. Okay, we're getting closer. So to kind of hang in there and don't give up too early. In other words, don't expect to hit the bullseye on the first shot.
Okay. In Feeling Time by Maximizing Motivation, you used an example about checking in with your boss more frequently. Mm-hmm. What if you are self-employed and have projects, but you're the client, the employer, and the employee? So basically, you're a solopreneur working by yourself. What would you recommend?
Right. Yeah, that's a less and less uncommon situation.
Mm-hmm.
I work for myself, so I can relate to that. It's a harder situation because there isn't as much of that external accountability. There isn't somebody looking over your shoulder. So on the one hand, you know, the sort of easy to say response to that would be that, you know, maybe then you need to kind of hold yourself to that, and maybe that you put in your schedule, like, you know, status check Henderson report, Wednesday at 10, and that you really commit yourself to honoring that appointment with yourself and really being honest, like, where am I at? Am I where I should be for Wednesday at 10 on this thing? Another option is, you know, there are various kind of like peer groups that you can be a part of, or like peer coaching or peer mentoring or whatever, peer accountability, where you find some other solopreneur or a friend or colleague who you can kind of do these check-ins with, and you hold each other accountable. So it's a relationship of equals that's mutually beneficial. But then there's also, there are coaches and there are therapists and there are other kind of professionals, if this is really kind of a struggle, that you can use, or business consultants or whatever, who will offer some of that external accountability if that's something that, you know, is really important to you.
Yeah, that's great advice. And hiring an assistant to, like, remind you, someone you pay, like, what you pay a babysitter, or, you know, it doesn't have to be really expensive, can make a world of difference too. And I'm somebody who's done it both ways. I've worked with coaches, I've worked with assistants, and I just came out of almost a two-year period where I was all by myself, and my business was struggling, and it was very frustrating. So I bit the bullet and hired a coach and a new assistant, and it's helpful. So I think there's other people out there that can help you, but yeah, it may help your business to connect with somebody else, like the peer groups that you talked about. That you know, is no cost, and that can be helpful too.
Yeah, and then it's money well spent. And if you're going to hire an assistant,
yes,
not hire a mousy assistant who's not going to tell you things. You want to hire an assistant who's got a pair, who can say, look, you're supposed to have that thing done by 10. Where is it? Not like in an ogre way, but in a, busting your chops in a helpful way here. Come on, man. You said you're going to do this. Where is it?
Do you have any apps or anything that you can recommend that help for time management? We had a few questions. I know there's probably a million and one apps, but are there any that you know of specifically that you use or colleagues have recommended to you?
You know, I have to admit, I don't keep up on the apps and stuff because there are so many options, and they're so, like, you know, they're, maybe I can't say that all of them are good for at least somebody, because probably there's a couple that are terrible for everybody, but you know, it's really a matter of finding what is it that's going to work for you. And there's a balancing act between what is, you need it to have enough functionality to do what you need to do, but it needs to be quick and simple enough that you can use it quickly. And because, like I said before, the quicker you can do something, the more likely you are to do it. If it's a hassle, if there are too many drop downs, if there are too many steps, you're just not going to use it. So my advice is to, generally speaking, keep it simple. find something that's stable, that's compatible with the devices that you have, and don't overdo it and don't overthink it and don't go kind of crazy on it. Generally, I tend to sort of throw this one to another guy out there in the world of ADHD, Eric Tivers, because he's kind of like weirdly obsessed with all these apps and gizmos and stuff, and he does a great job of sorting through, because he gets all of it and tries it all out and sorting through what works really well and what maybe doesn't work as well.
Okay. Well, we are actually at the end of the hour. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave people with tonight? And could you give out your website information?
Sure. So, well, I'll start with a website. So that's adultadhdbook.com. But final thoughts here. Just, you know, like I said in the beginning of last week, this started out as a one-hour presentation, and I absolutely can appreciate the irony of a one-hour time management presentation growing into 2 hours. But, you know, my hope is that by getting into some of this more technical stuff, by kind of going deeper on why time is such a struggle for folks with ADHD, and therefore understanding that in order to set us up for understanding why some strategies are going to work better than others, you know, I hope that, first of all, that it all made sense, or at least most of it made sense, in that it really kind of deepened your understanding of this, and not just about ADHD, but about time and about time management more broadly, so that you can really kind of become an expert in this and become an expert in your own ability to be aware of time and to manage time and to use it to be able to get done the things that you want to get done. So it's a little bit of a lofty goal. So it's not just throwing out, you know, like here's 20 time management strategies, have at it. But my hope is that the payoff is worth it, that, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about this and working on my notes for this, but I hope that the payoff for you is worth it as well, that the spending these couple hours and listening, and maybe even if you want to go back and listen to the recording and really kind of process it and think about it, and that that payoff is going to be worth it in terms of being able to feel better about this stuff and use it more effectively.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Dr. Ari Tachman, and thank you, everyone, for listening to tonight's